week of October 15th, 2017, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 384, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, I'm Michael Giltz. Hey, I forgot to ask you a question before the show began. Is there going to be a show next week?
Yes, there is. Although there wasn't going to be a show this week. Do you know why?
No.
Actually, maybe there would have been a show, but I was supposed to be in New York with you, in fact, this week. Because tomorrow we were supposed to go see Springsteen on Broadway.
But then you decided mortgaging the house was not a good idea.
Yeah, my kids need to go to college, you know.
Exactly. Yeah, every week before the show, I'm usually available because I have no life. You actually travel and have business and family obligations. So I usually ask you before each show, is there a show next week? Just so we can let people know, hey, you know, there won't be one next week right at the top of the show. But clearly we'll be here next week, and that's great news. And so you should all be so happy that we're going to be here next week. You should rate and review our show. You know why? Because I have a friend, John Aravosis. He has a blog called America Blog. It's a left-wing political progressive blog. And now I've started doing podcasts, the Unprecedented podcast, and it's on iTunes and all that stuff. He's done it for a few weeks, and he already has more reviews and rates than we do.
And we've been doing it for years.
Years. And I'm embarrassed. And we have more listeners than him, I imagine. I'm humiliated that he already has more reviews. What's your excuse? Come on. Do it while you're listening to the show.
That's true. You could do it right now, in fact. Just go to iTunes or, you know, what is it, Stitcher or the Microsoft Marketplace, the Google Play, wherever they give podcasts away for free. You can subscribe and rate and review the show. Please do.
Yes. And, you know, get your assistant to do it if you're too busy.
That's true. Yes. That would not be far from what might happen in Hollywood.
That's right. So when they and their assistant are listening to our show this week, which they will give 5 stars, what will they hear about?
Well, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we'll discuss the very public collapse of a media fixture in Hollywood.
Oh, again.
Well, of course, we're talking about Megyn Kelly, who has taken over 1 hour of NBC's hugely valuable Today Show franchise and quickly gone from awkward, well, to downright awful in the ratings. And we're going to be doing this on Inside Baseball, where we'll be joined by TV insider Mark Berman of Programming Insider. He'll talk to us about Megyn Kelly's ratings, how NBC would rather not talk about them, and what, if anything, can be done to fix their boondoggle. But, of course, we'll also talk about the implosion of the media fixture that you no doubt initially thought I was referring to moments ago, Harvey Weinstein. We'll run down the latest news, the attempt by his brother Bob Weinstein to save the company they founded, and how the scandal has moved beyond Harvey to encompass a culture of sexual harassment that pervades Hollywood. Michael has an idea for the first step that Hollywood could take today, in fact, to end it. During our book filter segment, Michael will suggest another cookbook that would make a great movie. You had one just a few weeks ago, so this should be interesting.
What can I say?
You're hungry. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right. And we're looking at box office around the world. We have a link to ComScore in our show notes. We also pull info from Box Office Profit, Box Office Mojo, Variety, Hollywood Reporter. The number one movie around the world is, of course, Blade Runner 2049. $44 million on the weekend, $160 million worldwide. So that just about matches the film's budget. So they need to triple that in order to get into the clear success story. I don't think they're going to make it. They still have China and I think Japan to go. It opened in South Korea, I think, and opened very poorly. So, you know, their hopes are fading for this one.
You know what? Don't make a three-hour movie. That's one of my comments there is, of course, get good reviews, but also don't make a three-hour movie. Nobody has the time to invest when they know they're going in for a three-hour movie these days.
No, I disagree. I think if it's good, 3 hours is short.
That's
if it's
true.
Bad in 80 minutes, it's long. And number two is Happy Death Day, another horror flick from Blumhouse. Just a $5 million budget, and in its opening weekend worldwide in 12 territories, it has made $32 million. So boom, success rate. The biggest problem with Blade Runner is it costs too much money given the franchise potential.
Well, and a lot of hay was made here in North America over the fact that Happy Death Day outpaced Blade Runner 2049 by, you know, 50% almost.
Well, you know, Blade Runner fell hard in its second weekend. It did not gain traction. The studio tried to pretend that word of mouth was good and that Saturday billed on Friday, that first weekend. The numbers seemed to back them up a little bit, but all I heard was people saying, oh, I wasn't thrilled with it. So I think the truth is now there that Blade Runner is not going to have long legs, at least in North America. And number three is a movie that is having legs. It's Never Say Die, a Chinese comedy about body swapping. $30 million on the weekend, $280 million worldwide. Yet another Chinese film that's going to be among the biggest box office hits of the year worldwide.
And in fact, I think it's the most successful comedy worldwide ever.
No, it's not.
I thought I read that in the Hollywood Reporter. Maybe
you mean most successful Chinese comedy?
Well, maybe. Maybe that's what they were referring to.
I mean, wasn't The Mermaid sort of a light romantic comedy?
I don't know. It says, Never Say Die becomes biggest single market. Sorry. Talk about a qualifier. Biggest single market comedy ever with $280 million.
You mean it's China's biggest hit comedy?
Yeah, probably. That's probably.
Right. I mean, maybe that's true. That I don't have. And it's difficult to separate the action comedies from the romantic comedies from the comedy comedies. So, you know, those sort of little genre qualifiers are tricky to go with. But what I do know is that Kingsman, The Golden Circle, made another $21 million on the weekend. That's just under $300 million worldwide. So that's going to be a success. There will be another Kingsman film. Hopefully that one will be good. Because I think they saw the potential there, whereas the Bond films got darker and more serious. And Kingsman, the first one, seemed like a throwback to the Roger Moore era. Sexy, fun James Bond, right?
Right.
And younger.
Yes.
And, you know, they could have kept that. But instead, they just started to spoof the series and just make it so ridiculous that it had no rooting in reality. And the part two was just dumb. You know, it was just over the top nonsense. And I wish they just sort of said, hey, let's make a fun, sexy young James Bond. We can have a little wink. But, you know, they had that opening. And I think they failed to follow through on the second one. But they're going to get another chance.
I think you're right.
Yeah. At number five is The Foreigner, a Jackie Chan action film, $18 million on the weekend, $90 million worldwide. And now we have some budget info. Some people claim that this movie, I think it's directed by Martin Campbell. It co-stars Pierce Brosnan and Jackie Chan. They say it only has a budget of $35 million. I'm going to put an asterisk by that one because I feel like with those people involved, maybe they got a little bit of the back end. I don't know.
Well, but maybe not. In fact, I mean,
late in the day for their careers.
Well, not Pierce Brosnan per se. I mean, he probably.
Oh, yes, per se.
Yeah, know. He probably was paid quite a big chunk of change up front. With Jackie Chan, it might, you know, yeah. I mean, there might be some back end, but he might be saying, "Look, I'm 65 years old. I'm playing this character. This could be. I can't be." Be asking for a lot
I'll
here.
I'll bet Jackie Chan got more money than Pierce Brosnan.
I bet you're right.
Yeah, but $35 million, if that's true, it's pretty much already tripled its budget, so that's another success story. Just like Bad Genius at number six, I think this is the Thai film we talked about before. It's a movie about teenagers cheating on their SATs, or the equivalent, and it's staged like kind of a 1970s heist flick. It made $17 million on the weekend, but that's includes about $10 million it made prior to this. It's in four territories now. I think this is that film. It had a run in Thailand and made a lot of money. Now I think it's opened up in some other territories. Sometimes it's tricky to figure out what movies they're actually talking about. We had another movie down lower that whose title changed over the weekend, at least had the English translation of it. But this flick, teenagers cheating on the SATs, staged like a heist flick. It deals with class and inequality and gender and race. My God, Hollywood, are you remaking this movie?
But they probably are now.
Yeah, it seems ripe for remake. And number seven is It, which of course is going to get not a sequel, but the part two that it needs to finish telling that story. The Stephen King horror flick made $16 million on the weekend, $630 million worldwide, and it's still got Halloween coming up.
Well, and think about it. I mean, it's such a culture magnet at this point. It's such a part of the culture, this film, that on Saturday Night Live, they had Kellyanne Conway. They mocked Kellyanne Conway by doing Kelly Wise, and she was in the sewer with all of her makeup all askew. Did you see that?
I don't watch Saturday Night Live.
It was actually that, I have to say. That little bit was she was trying to coax Anderson Cooper from CNN into the sewer. It was very funny.
Cool. And number eight is the Lego Ninjago movie, another $13 million on the weekend, $96 million worldwide. And number nine is The Mountain Between Us, starring Kate Winslet, who I just saw in Wonder Wheel, the new Woody Allen film. This movie co-stars Idris Elba and grossed $10 million on the weekend. That's at $30 million worldwide. Here's a film opening up overseas because it looks like it's mostly an American film. It's Geostorm, starring Gerard Butler, who seems determined to be in as many bad movies as possible. $9 million on the weekend. The trailer for this movie looks dumb.
It's almost like, you know, White House Down or whatever.
Yeah, he's like, oh, no, I'm sorry, this script is too good. I can't do it. And number 11 is The Snowman, starring Michael Fassbender. This is kind of a bummer. It's $9 million on the weekend, and that may be fine because the budget looks like it's $5 million. That's what some people are reporting. But this is the latest film from director Tomas Alfredson, who did Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy and Let the Right One In, both of which are terrific. This movie seems to be getting very poor reviews, so it's a bummer to see that he's had a misfire here. My Little Pony is right below that, $9 million on the weekend. That's at $27 million worldwide. Tom Cruise, has this movie opened up here yet?
Yes, it has, and that should tell you whether it's a success or not.
That's right. It has. It's sort of. In fact, a doorman was saying, I like that movie. He liked it. He was telling people to go see it. I was just hearing him yesterday say that. I don't know why I blacked out on that, but the Tom Cruise flick made $8 million on the weekend. That's at $112 million worldwide. If you believe the budget of $50 million, then this is getting close to being an okay, you know, given his name brand. If you assume that budget and they're not going to take a lot of money out of the back end because there isn't a lot of back end, they'll be okay. It isn't going to be a big winner, but they're going to be all right.
Yeah, however, it does kind of take a, you know, the Cruise brand takes a hit. And that's pretty much what the story is here is the G, you know, we think Tom Cruise would open up to, you know, $40, $50, $60 million. And it didn't open up to that. Well, I would say I would agree with you, Michael, and say, you know what, if you're making a film that only costs $50 million, you're not going to have a $200 million marketing campaign. So when the film opens to, you know, $15, $20 million or even $10 million, you know, you're not going to be too bad if it winds up in North America at, you know, $40 million.
Yeah. And he's had, you know, 30 years, 35 years of success. You know, he's going to be all right. Everybody's star fades a little bit eventually, but he's got another Mission Impossible movie coming up. You know, he's going to be okay. Tom Cruise is not suddenly unbankable.
Right.
At number 14 is The Outlaws, though last week we called it Crime City. I think this is the same film. Again, when you're dealing with worldwide box office, it can be tricky. And if you ever hear us making a mistake or missing out on a movie that's a big hit in your territory that should be on the charts, let us know.
That's right. You can write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's D-I-R-T at showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263.
So this movie, The Outlaws, aka Crime City, is a Korean thriller, and I think I have a better description of the plot now. Apparently, it's the true story of a turf war between a Korean and Chinese gangs, you know, turf war, gangsters, bad guys. $8 million on the weekend, $21 million worldwide. Below that is Chasing the Dragon, the new Andy Lau film, $7 million on the weekend, just about $80 million worldwide. And right below that is City of Rock. Again, China had a big holiday, a lot of movies opened up, and almost all of them, as far as we can tell, look like they're going to be success stories at the box office. That's a darn good couple of weeks in China. City of Rock is a comedy about a guy throwing a rock concert to save a rock garden. Sounds like a joke, but it's not. $7 million on the weekend, $55 million worldwide. I made a mistake about Judi Dench. I said Victoria and Abdul looked like her swan song. It was unlikely she'd ever make another film. Well, this movie grossed $5 million on the weekend. It's at $40 million worldwide. And I forgot to note, she's got a movie in the can.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Murder on the Orient Express.
That's right. So she's got that movie coming up. Hopefully that, you know, I'm not sure what to think about that film, but I'm looking forward to seeing it in some sort of goofy way. So she's got that. Hopefully that'll be a better film and a better swan song for her. She's also been mentioned for Artemis Fowl, which is a new film also directed by Kenneth Branagh, who did Murder on the Orient Express. This movie is an adaptation of a children's book. It's sort of a fantasy, action, adventure, mystery series. I thought maybe it was an animated version, but it's not. It's live action. I have no idea who she would play, but it's not even going to happen for a year before they start filming. So I think she'll probably drop out of that one.
Yeah. I mean, how old is she? She's in her 80s, isn't she?
Well, yeah, but more importantly, she's frail. You know, people can act into their late 80s, into their 90s. It's just a question of what they're up for. But, you know, with her vision going and seeming to be not physically up to the challenge, she's clearly never going to do theater again. And it looks like film is getting to the end.
And she never won an Oscar, did she?
Yeah, sure. Of course she did. She won an Oscar for playing the Queen, didn't she?
I don't know. I always thought it was, you know, well, now I'm wondering.
She's been nominated for the Oscars 7 times, and she won Best Supporting Actress playing Queen Elizabeth in Shakespeare in Love.
Okay, so never mind. You're right. I take it back. You're right.
She's quite lauded. She's doing all right. She's got a full shelf of awards. She'll be okay. Here's a movie. I have no idea what it is. Hold Your Hands.
Okay.
Look that one up, and you get I Want to Hold Your Hand, a fun little Robert Zemeckis film. This has a distributor of HUAX, which sounds like it's an Asian company.
Oh, my God. They're coming after you, Michael. They finally found you.
14 floors above, and that is loud. I'll tell you that. So this movie, Hold Your Hands, probably an Asian film, $4.3 million on the weekend. It's a mystery what it might be. But here's a new movie. It's a Russian drama called Salyut 7. It's based on the true story of Russian space program going into space to repair a satellite that was fading and dead and about to go into the atmosphere and fall and hit the Earth. They went up in 1985 and they repaired it and brought it back to life. It's the first time that was ever done in space back in 1985. And this is a film about that drama, sort of Apollo 13 with an even happier ending. $3.6 million on the weekend. We think the budget is about $7 million. That's a pretty good start. And going down, the Met Opera had another live showcase of The Magic Flute. That one made $2.8 million in 6 different territories. And at number 26, here's one more film to talk about. It's the Condorito, La Película. This is an animated film based on the Chilean comic strip, which has been around for like 66 years or longer. I demand an explanation of what this is about. Well, let me tell you. Condorito is a long-running comic strip, pretty aggressive in its attitude, sort of, you know, sexy women, and it made fun of hippies and liberals. And because of its sort of non-political nature and sort of regressive attitude, this comic strip stayed in print even during repressive regimes. So it's got that sort of weird history. It also seems an odd film. It doesn't seem terribly family-friendly, but I guess most of the jokes were supposed to go over kids' heads when they looked at the comic strip. But they made it a film. It's an institution in Chile, and I assume across Latin America. $2.5 million on its opening weekend for that one. And one more little note, Annabelle Creation, that's the horror film in the Conjuring series that finally passed the $300 million mark worldwide. Good God, those have made a lot of money.
And what's interesting about the whole Magic Flute thing with the Met Live in HD is I'm pretty sure back in 2006, that's where Live in HD for the Met started, with the Magic Flute.
It's a perennial. And could you buy your tickets on Fandango if you wanted to go to that thing, or do you have to buy it through Fathom Events? Is it available via Fandango and movietickets.com?
Well, and here's the rub, and I know what you're getting at, is that Fandango, actually, that's a online movie ticket sales portal, okay? And it was originally started by a bunch of the movie theater chains and then it was sold off to Comcast. So Comcast owns it. And movietickets.com was their competitor. And
Comcast is Universal, right?
Yes.
So one studio owns it.
Well, the parent company does, yes.
Right, yeah.
So movietickets.com had been the leader in that space. And along comes Fandango and just, in my opinion, eats its lunch. Movietickets.com was founded by, I think, Regal and National Amusements and a bunch of other folks. There's a lot of overlap. And part of the problem for years was the fact that if you were a Fandango, if you sold your tickets as a movie theater owner through Fandango, you could only sell through Fandango. And vice versa, Movie Tickets said, you can only sell through us, you can't sell through Fandango. It's the reason that selling movie tickets through, say, Facebook became so difficult, because you already had exclusive deals. Now, Fandango and Movie Tickets, they started in the U.S. They started to kind of branch out into Europe. Movie Tickets did. Canada, movietickets.com did. And Fandango recently has been on an acquisition spree because they have been picking up Latin American entities such as, Cine Papaya I think it's Colombia and Peru, and Ingresso in Brazil. So there's a whole, you know, Fandango Latin America.
They're spreading all over the world. And to bury the headline, Fandango just bought movietickets.com.
Oh, I didn't say that already? I'm sorry. Yes, Fandango bought movietickets.com. Yes, so
that's right.
I thought I had said that. But yes, that's what happened here.
So as one company, they will now reach 40,000 screens worldwide. It's the first time Fandango's had a presence in Canada and the UK. So they own They're going to be separate. I don't know why or what that would mean. What's the point of having a separate?
That has to be some legal and accounting thing, because Regal owns a portion of movietickets.com. And I think AMC is in bed with Fandango in some way. So there has to be some kind of collusion. There's a reason for that. Much like there's a reason why in Brazil, Ingresso still exists, as opposed to Fandango Latin America, which is what now exists in Peru, in Colombia, everywhere else that Fandango purchased Cine Papaya.
Well, that's lovely, but I don't understand how the deal could go through in the first place, since they now own the entire market. That's my point. Not that there's shadow play that they're doing to pretend that they're meeting the law, the legal requirements. But in fact, give me a break. You now have one company selling every ticket in America.
Well, there is Atom Tickets, which is owned in part by, I think, Disney.
And their market presence, how much of the market do they control?
There's the rub. Not much.
Right. So 90% of the market is controlled by Fandango.
It's growing. But I also think that now, unlike in previous times, there is no more exclusivity. So if you're Atom Tickets, you can sell through, you know, you can pick up theaters and circuits that sold through Fandango or Movie Tickets, and Movie Tickets .com and Fandango can't demand exclusivity.
And you can go straight to the box office. But the fact is, Fandango now, if you're buying tickets online, they control well over 90% of the market.
Yes, and let's face it, movietickets.com kind of knew, hey, we do not have the deep pockets that a Comcast has, so Fandango will always have more resources than us.
Yeah, I understand that, but I'm just saying, market-wise, they control the entire market. 90% of the market is controlled by Fandango.
Yes, in one way or another now, yes.
Yeah, and they also own Rotten Tomatoes and Flixster.
That's right, which is why you see Rotten Tomatoes scores next to Movie Tickets on Fandango, which the
drives studios
yeah,
nuts.
Exactly.
we have a new segment, This Week in Adaptations, reboots and spinoffs, because it never ends. The board game Settlers of Catan is going to become a movie at Sony. The surfing flick Blue Crush, Chick Surfers, which is how Hollywood describe it, that's going to be a show on NBC. And the TV series Roswell will become a TV series named Roswell. One is really the one that just made me go, oh, stop. For God's sake, stop. Just because it existed does not mean it has to exist again.
Well, what about Hawaii 5-0?
Well, exactly. No, again, that's yet another example of the endless, you know, this is the problem. There are 500 scripted shows on TV. Every channel wants their own original programming. And there's only so many ideas in the world. When you're trying to come up with something to gain traction, the visibility of an actual name that people recognize gives you a leg up, and it's hard to resist. So when Hollywood isn't spending its time thinking of boring reboots, they are talking about Harvey Weinstein, of course, because that's all anybody can talk about right now. But happily, it's not just Harvey Weinstein we're talking about anymore. It's really the culture of Hollywood, isn't it?
Yeah, I guess it is time to dive into Harvey Weinstein again. And frankly, so much has happened in 10 days. It's kind of hard to remember what we covered last week and what is new information. But one thing really is clear. This story has grown from the Harvey Weinstein scandal into possibly the Hollywood scandal of pervasive sexual harassment and assault. No one wanting to break into the business should have to fend off sleazy offers, compromising positions, being forced to stand up to powerful and influential people or the casting couch. None of this is unique to Hollywood, but given the fact that it's the dream factory and Hollywood traffics in sexy films and TV shows starring beautiful young men and women, clearly it's a problem here, perhaps more than anywhere else. Will anything change? Probably not easily. Here's the latest, assuming nothing has happened since we began recording today. Harvey Weinstein has rightly seen his entire world collapse. Decades of preying on women, threats of blackballing and promises of fame, harassment, assault, and rape have finally caught up with him. He's been fired from the company with his name on it, disowned by his brother, and abandoned by virtually everyone, including, by the way, his wife and pretty much any institution he's ever been associated with, from the Academy Awards or the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences to BAFTA to charities, colleges, and so much more. And every day, more and more women come forward with stories of how Harvey Weinstein mauled them, hit on them, pressured them to have sex, and much worse. Police in London and New York City have opened, or should we say reopened, investigations on him. What comes next for Harvey depends on his ability to show genuine remorse and seek help. If he's lucky, he'll be able to spend the rest of his life making amends. But he won't be making movies or TV shows ever again. At least
do you think that's true?
I think.
Do you think 5 years he could make a comeback and say, oh, I've gotten better and I'm a new person?
I think if he was maybe 45, sure. But I think at 65, it would take him a good 5 years just to kind of, you know, rebalance himself, maybe another 5 years to get a project off the ground, and he'd be, you know, in his late 70s, maybe. I mean, look, even Mel Gibson is able to make movies today. So mm-hmm. as much as of a pariah as Mel Gibson is, not only in Hollywood, but he was a pariah just in society, having, you know, been in a grocery store with that guy, you know, 2 years, 3 years after his whole, you know, implosion. I can tell you what it's like when he walked through a grocery store and like literally the hush fell over an entire grocery store.
Well, now here's the thing. People already, God forbid, we're just starting to talk about harassment and taking women and men seriously when they say, I've been harassed, I've been assaulted, you know, instead of shaming them and saying, well, why did you do it? Why did you go to the hotel room? What you were asking for, like Donna Karan. Most people now today are starting to take this seriously. But the second that happens, other people say, oh, it's a witch hunt now. It's a witch hunt. Woody Allen says, let's not have a witch hunt. To which I say, Woody Allen, you really shouldn't comment on this case. And, you know, well, oh, my God, they're throwing him out of the academy. Are they going to throw out all the rapists in the academy? It's like, you know, you can throw out one person without meaning you have to suddenly send private eyes to investigate everyone's private life. This is not about judging the personal character of people, or maybe nobody would be in Hollywood. It's about, you know, their professional behavior to a degree. This is kind of like Pete Rose gambling in baseball. Harvey Weinstein was using his power as an executive, his ability to have auditions and ask people to come see him, and he was abusing that in horrific way. So in a sense, it was really about his work behavior and the shame and shadow he put on Hollywood. And you know what? So what? If you throw him out, it doesn't mean you have to suddenly, you know, oh, they're going to throw everyone out. It's like, no. Just because you put a speed limit doesn't mean you're going to eliminate cars, you know? So it's okay. They're throwing him out of the academy. Should they have? Of course. Why not?
Well, he, as you say, he used the industry he used the industry in the crime, basically.
But so did Roman Polanski and so did Bill Cosby, to which you say, good point. I don't disagree. That doesn't mean I'm sorry that they did this step. Right.
Correct.
You know, just because you maybe think there are other people who should have been kicked out of the academy, we're glad they took this step. Should they have kept him in the academy? No. Why should they? It's a place of honor. It's not a constitutional right like voting. It's just an academy where you're honored to be a member. And if they want to kick you out, why shouldn't they? Is this a good reason? I think so.
Well, and keep in mind that this is an institution, the AMPAS, where his name was so associated with it. There were jokes about them being called the Harveys at one point because he won so many of them, or, you know, he basically created the modern Oscar campaign and actually built it up from, you know, this annual event that, yeah, you had to spend a few dollars on, to an annual event where you had to spend as much money marketing for the Oscars as you did in marketing the film itself. And people were actually, you know, ticked off about that, especially the Academy. And so in a way, it's they just rewards, I guess. They're looking at it as, hey, you know what? We weren't very happy with what, you know, with how you were campaigning and what you did to all the studios to make them campaign on such a level. Guess what? This is payback.
Now, and maybe if you're a boorish jerk, people are not there to catch you back. If you're a good person who makes a mistake and treat people nicely, you get more second chances. If you're a jerk, people are happier to stab you in the back when they get the chance.
Well, and I always go back to, and I know I've told this story on this show in years past, I go back to Ron Meyer, who's now the head of Universal. And he, when he had just left CAA and I was there, he would come back from time to time and give young agents and young executives, a little kind of masterclass. And he would talk about the difference between Sylvester Stallone and John Travolta. And he said when they both were trying to make a comeback.
But except they both have made comebacks and very successfully.
Right. But this was in the 90s. Okay.
So, okay. I don't know if it works anymore, though.
But just hear me out here. In the late 70s, early 80s, John Travolta and Sylvester Stallone were big, big stars. Stallone went after the money. He did this movie Rhinestone for $12 million, which at the time was unheard of. And it was a big flop. And Ron Meyer said, look, don't do this because it's a bad movie. It's going to tarnish your reputation. And, you know, Stallone was kind of not pleasant to most of the people around him. Whereas John Travolta was nice to everybody around him. And in 1993-94, when both were trying to make comebacks, Travolta did so in Pulp Fiction, and everybody in the industry wanted to see him be a success. Stallone, on the other hand, who did Copland, nobody cared. Nobody cared whether he ever made a comeback at all, because you know what? They had such a sour taste in their mouth from having personal interactions with him that weren't necessarily good that they kind of said, you know what? You're on your own. And you know what? I've had personal interactions with Harvey Weinstein, none of which were good. And so, you know what? I would not be there in this instance. Now, granted, this is sexual assault. I wouldn't be there for him at all anyway. But, you know, I feel in a way, much like Eric Fellner does, he's a producer for Working Title, that, you know, finally, after all these years, we get to say what we've always felt about Harvey Weinstein.
All right, well, here's a big question. Can the Weinstein Company be saved? Obviously, they have to change the name, and they will. Projects are fleeing from the company. I mean, Harvey's name is being taken off every possible future project that there is, movie and TV. Some projects have collapsed. Some people say we want our project back, like Lin-Manuel Miranda. He's like, can I please have In the Heights back? It's in crisis mode. But Bob Weinstein has insisted, hey, look, I haven't spoken to this guy in 5 years, essentially. I was divorced from my brothers, and many people knew this. Don't blame the hundreds of employees at Weinstein Company for this jerk's behavior. We have good projects in the future. We have a financial lifeline. This can be saved. Don't punish us for what he did. Can he make that case, and will it work?
Well, I know that a lot of people will point to Fox News. Hey, it didn't, go out of business after their little scandal.
Unfortunately.
Well, but the reality is they're a multi-billion-dollar organization backed by another multi-billion-dollar organization. The Weinstein...
They're the number one earner of Fox. You know, they churn out the most money. So, yeah, exactly. They're the most valuable property that Fox has, as opposed to the Weinstein Company, which is not.
Right. And I would say that in this case, you know, you have a company that's struggling to pay its bills constantly. You have Bob Weinstein, whose name is not going to change. OK, so did he know? Did he not know? I do know that everybody that's ever worked for the Weinsteins will tell you that Bob and Harvey, they were always pictured together. They did not get along at all. It's the reason Bob went off and formed Dimension, simply to get away from his brother.
He says he hadn't spoken to him more than 10 times in the last 5 years. Literally twice a year, he says, I spoke to this guy. I mean, they were not speaking on speaking terms. That's what he says. I don't know if it's true. They're going to have to, the board and Bob are going to have to do some extra effort to exonerate themselves and show their lack of awareness about what literally was. He says, I knew he was a dog. As far as he understood that he was cheating on his wife, I called him on it. I didn't like it. I knew he had a horrible temper. I wanted nothing to do with him, and I moved to the other coast. That's what he says.
Right.
He made sort of a good argument in his first case. I think he made a good opening argument. Whether it's enough to save the company, I don't know. Is there enough goodwill for the other people at that company and Bob Weinstein? I don't know. He's made people a lot of money.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I think at this point, people just want to turn their back on it and not have any association with it at all. So,
well, we'll rename it, obviously, and pretend it's a new company.
Yeah, so I know that there's some talk that a private equity firm will buy it out and then maybe try and turn it around. I don't know how successful that would be.
Okay, so if they're still in crisis, obviously they're in crisis mode, but you're kind of doubtful that this company will survive in any form.
It's going to be very difficult.
Yeah, well, you can catch up on all the different stories of women who have come forward. It's like 30 and counting every hour, practically, a new actress. And we're talking some of the biggest names in Hollywood say, he really aggressively harassed me. He raped me, says Rose McGowan. He jumped on me and tried to kiss me, Lissa's Leia Seydoux. Really unpleasant, awful things that no one should have to deal with. I love the Sarah Polley op-ed in the New York Times. She wrote, and it was a fascinating piece where she was suddenly dragged out of a photo shoot where she was dressed sexy and said, Harvey wants to meet you, and just bundled off out of nowhere to go with a meeting with him. And she had a publicist with her, and the publicist said, I'm staying by your side. I'm not going to leave you. And she's like, well, that told her everything she needed to know about Harvey Weinstein right in that moment. She was very grateful that that woman did that. And he propositioned her and made all these sort of offers. And she was like, I don't care about my acting career. I don't really care about acting. So she's like, you're not offering me anything I want. She was a very self-possessed young woman. And so none of his verbal offers were tempting. So she's like, whatever, go away.
This but is a woman, by the way, Sarah Polley, who has, you know, told me the story of how she was, you know, I think it was Vogue or Cosmopolitan. She basically turned down the cover because they wanted to airbrush her. And she said, no, no makeup, no airbrushing. And if that's not fine with you, then I'm fine with not being on the cover.
Yeah. And she probably wasn't willing to dress like a whore. Because that's what often you're asked to do when you're a woman in Hollywood. Oh, you got to dress and make yourself look, you know, ridiculous.
I love Léa Seydoux's whole thing. You know, she's French, great French actress. She said, you know, oh, he jumped on top of me and tried to kiss me. And you know,
he assaulted her. Yeah.
Yeah. And he's just so fat. I couldn't get away from him.
Yeah, well, he's much so bigger and stronger than she is. Absolutely.
So
but
direct.
Sarah Polley wrote in the New York Times, Harvey Weinstein may be the central casting version of a Hollywood predator, but he was just one festering pustule in a diseased industry. The only thing that shocked most people in the film industry about the Harvey Weinstein story was that suddenly, for some reason, people seemed to care. And that knowledge alone allowed a lot of us to breathe for the first time in ages.
That's a great, great quote.
And it goes to the case that a woman came forward to talk about Steven Seagal and his sleazy attempts at getting her to sleep with him. People questioning Ben Affleck's behavior on Total Request Live many years ago, for which he has apologized. Terry Crews, a large football player, talks about a man grabbing his crotch at a Hollywood party in front of Terry Crews' wife and just laughing at him when he jumped back. Like, what are you doing? Like, just man just treating him like a piece of meat. And he felt too humiliated and too constricted in what he could do. He couldn't hit him back. He felt like he knew the headline would be large black man hits little white boy. And it was embarrassing and humiliating. You feel ineffectual. And they just left the party. James Vanderbeek has talked about now how he was repeatedly harassed and propositioned when he was a young man. Men groped his ass, urged him to have sex with them so he could get ahead. This is not something a 17, 18, or 19 or anyone should ever have to deal with just because they want to be an actor. And, you know, brings us back to Corey Feldman, who years ago talked about how Corey Haim committed suicide. And there's a whole ring of Hollywood executives who toss around boys like toys to other executives and producers and directors, and the real problem of pedophilia in the industry. So this is not just one person. This is a culture of harassment and rape. And that leads us to Amazon and executive Roy Price, who suddenly has been kicked out of the company.
Yeah, so I guess a producer came forward and said, hey, you know, I know this, we're talking about Harvey Weinstein, but you know what? Actually, Roy Price, who's the head of Amazon, he did, you know, he kind of propositioned me. He did proposition me. I'm the producer on Man in the High Castle. Also, I think the daughter of Philip K. Dick, by the way. Yep. You know, and it was kind of not pleasant. And so Amazon said, you know what? We're going to suspend him without pay and do an investigation on this.
Not quite. What she said was, this happened years ago. I reported it immediately to Amazon. She's a producer on The Man in the High Castle, one of their first big high profile shows. She was heading to a party with him. You got kids listening to the show. You might want to tell them to cover their ears. He kept telling her, propositioning her, saying, you're going to love my d-. And he kept saying it again. And she's like, I'm a lesbian. I'm married. I have children. I'm not interested in your dick. And he kept aggressively hitting on her. They went to the party and he stood behind her and would say, anal sex, anal sex. I mean, just creepy and bizarre. And she reported it and they did an internal investigation. But she was never told the result. What she does know is that she never saw him again in a meeting, never had to deal with Roy Price. So they clearly said, stay away from her. But what we don't know is, was there anything else that Roy Price done? What did they find out when they did their investigation? And so the fact is, Amazon now said, okay, we're part of the story now, and it's very disappointing to us. He's been put on a leave or perhaps even fired. I forget what the latest is. But now we need to know, well, what happened 2 years ago? Why wasn't he suspended or fired then? Were there other incidents and other people? So, you know, so the fact that they have suddenly now acted on this, he could probably sue for being fired without cause. Since, you know, if what he did 2 years ago was investigated and he was cleared and you kept him in your job, why are you kicking him out now? So it's a big mess there. And that story is not over for Amazon. And the fact is that they dealt with this 2 years ago by leaving him in power.
Yeah, and I guess one of the things, I think I said it last week, I'll say it again really quickly, which is, you know, a lot of people are saying, how could Meryl Streep or George Clooney not know? But remember, these are people that you know, assistants kind of shelter them. And I'm not saying that they shouldn't know, but, you know, you hear accusations of all types, of all sorts, about all types of people and all sorts of people. These are kind of egregious. But and you know what? There's no proof. There's no. It's always kind of like a rumor thing that you always kind of wonder: is that true? Or you know, but very often assistants will kind of shelter stars like that from this type of news or this type these types of accusations, unless it's so you know prevalent and so in your face that it can't be ignored.
Well, there's two things here. One is that they hear crazy, ridiculous rumors about themselves all the time that have no basis in fact.
Correct.
It's in the tabloids. It's in the world. Richard Gere and gerbils. Everybody knows what I'm referring to. It's absurd. It's ridiculous. It's, you know, physically impossible. Doesn't matter. People want to believe it. And every time he had a hit film for decades, that would come up again. Just ridiculous. So when they hear they're cheating on their wife, their husband, they're a drug addict, they're dying of cancer, and they know it's all BS, they tend to become a little inured to all these stories. So that doesn't excuse, you know, some serious, where if a friend comes to you and says something, but that is the world they live in. But what you said was more interesting in the sense that, you know, they've got to deal with Harvey and their assistants know they do. And if Harvey screams at an assistant, to give a really banal example, and treats them like dirt, do they run and go tell Meryl Streep? Probably not, because she has to have a relationship with him. She has to be polite and friendly to him. And why are you putting it on her where she has to act on it? And so they might just not share that with her. And so they really do get in a bubble to a degree. This is not to excuse anyone. Information gets through. But, you know, they're not running to tell them negative things about somebody that they have to work with and talk to and have a polite, friendly relationship with. Because when they're at a party or an event, they got to chit chat with them. And being told things that you don't have to tell them, you know, you're not going to do it necessarily. You talked about that with Nicolas Cage, right? People wouldn't run and tell him all the nasty, negative, awful things they heard about this person or how they were treated.
Yeah, well, because, you know, then you become part of the problem of spreading the rumor.
Well, not rumor. Like, if he treats you like dirt, I don't mean sexual assault or harassment. I'm saying he's yelling and screaming at you. You're not going to necessarily run and tell your boss, Nicolas Cage or Meryl Streep or George Clooney, because they're going to have to chat with him and sit with them at dinner the next night.
Right.
You know, you want to force them to have an awkward conversation, to chide them on it. You know, it's like you don't necessarily run and tell them stuff, much less rumors that you haven't experienced firsthand. So they are in a little bit of a bubble and they do get used to hearing ridiculous rumors that aren't true. What's her name? Gretchen Mol had a good story. She said, you know, for years, people said I slept with Harvey Weinstein to advance my career. It was just this ugly, awful rumor. It was started. She traced it back to this gossip website that just slapped together BS and fake anonymous sources and pretended they had the dirt on her. And she knew it wasn't true because it's her life. And so, you know, there was nothing much she could do about it legally. And she just ignored it. But she also says, when I heard other stories about Harvey and other women, I assumed those weren't true either. You know, and, you know, so the good and the bad of him and them. So, you know, when you know crazy stuff is said about you, then you're probably more likely not to listen to all the sorts of crazy, ridiculous rumors. That's different from the fact that a lot of people knew he was going to hit on women, to put it in the best, politest terms, and that it wasn't safe to send someone to an audition alone with him, which brings me to the point, like, what can change? What can happen now? And the only little thought I had is that this is not a magic bullet, but maybe it's a sensible first step and can send the right message while also taking the onus off of vulnerable actors and people in different guilds and make their guild the bad guy and not them. What I'm saying is casting directors. People I've spoken to, they've never worked on a film or TV project where the director or the producer wanted private auditions. They've never done it. They've never arranged it. They'd never be around that. Make that official. You won't work on a film or TV show where you know anybody is being sent for a casting session or an audition with a director or producer or executive. You won't arrange them. You won't do them. You won't work on a project where you learn that happens. Don't permit casting sessions in someone's private home or a hotel room. And if they can't afford an office, if it's that small of a film, guess what? You can go to Starbucks. You can go to the local library.
Wait a second. That last one, nobody knows where the local library is. Come on, let's face it.
Fair enough. If it happens, you can, you know, report it to your union and quit with cause. You could put it in the next contract, or better yet, add it to the current agreement. And imagine that studios are probably going to be eager to agree to that. SAG-AFTRA, they should make it official. You are not allowed to meet with a director or producer or executive for a private casting session. You cannot go to a private casting session at their home or the thing. You can't do it. There should be a casting director present. It should be in a public work setting. It should not be at someone's home. It should not be in their hotel room. You're not allowed to go. And that means when a director says, well, come upstairs to my room, you can say, I can't. I could lose my SAG card. That means you're no longer the person that has to tell them no, that that's onus is taken off of you. Same thing for directors and producers. They're not allowed to do it. They can't do it. We won't allow it. And if we see anybody, any of these other ones doing it, we're going to call them out on it. If Producers Guild, they won't work on a film where a director tries to do it. A director won't work with a producer who tries to do it. It's against their rules. It's not going to eliminate casting couches. It's not going to eliminate sexual harassment, but at least can eliminate one little, you know, a possibility, limit the possibilities for abuse and send the right message. There is something you can do.
Well, I know that, you know, look, I think you and I would both agree that you know, getting the unions to agree on anything with the studios, that can be difficult, but I don't think what you're suggesting is actually that far-fetched or that impossible. It certainly makes it harder to perpetrate such behavior, but I'm pretty sure one thing will occur, and that is at some point in the future, somebody will write a book. And I know that I usually say that to, you know, segue us into our book filter segment. I know somebody's going to write a book about this, don't you think?
Absolutely. Already are, I'm sure. They're crashing stories right now.
Well, that said, it is time for our Book Filter segment. Book Filter is a book lover's best friend, and every week, Michael, you and your team over at bookfilter.com, you pick a whole bunch of books that are coming out of the thousands that come out each week and tell us what we should be reading. Here on Showbiz Sandbox, you pick a few books that might be ripe for adaptation to films or television shows. What have you got for us this week?
Well, the big book of the week for me is The Book of Dust by Philip Pullman. He's a fantasy author. This is the first of a new trilogy set in the universe of his Dark Materials. It's sort of a midquel, or it's a series of books that take place around the same time as the first three books that he wrote. I love The Golden Compass. I interviewed Philip Pullman twice, went to his home in Oxford, so I'm a big, big fan of his work. I'm very excited that he comes back to this world, though I do feel kind of like he's trapped. You know, a lot of fantasy authors get trapped in the world that they create. J.K. Rowling's done a good job of staying out of that trap to a degree. It ain't easy, but I'm excited to read this book. But they're still adapting The Golden Compass. That's being turned into a BBC series. So if you're looking for a book to option, I would recommend Unforgettable. This is a cookbook / biography of the legendary cookbook author Paula Wolfert. She doesn't have the name recognition of James Beard or Julia Child or the two fat ladies even, but foodies recognize her as one of the greats. Alice Waters is quoted on the book cover talking about how important she was. She was a real trailblazer in the 60s and beyond. She hung out with Allen Ginsberg and the Beats. She worked for James Beard. She touted international cuisine. And there's a couple periods of her life that would be great for turning into a movie. There's the period in the 60s when she lived in Morocco. And that was pretty adventurous at the time. That wasn't like today. Sometimes living overseas, you were really in a different world and you didn't have access to the rest of the world the way you do today. And when she was there, she discovered cuisine that she would bring back to the U.S. There's the time in college when she found her life's passion. She was going to school and her mom gave her a gift of cooking classes with this great English chef who was in New York City. And she says, quote, "I loved it. I loved it better than school. I grew up on cottage cheese and melon, and my mother was on a diet her whole life. She had no interest in food." And so seeing that young person discover their passion would be fun. And there's today. Paula Wolfert is alive. She's dealing with Alzheimer's. And it's, of course, heartbreaking to watch her mind break down. And she can struggle to remember what happened yesterday or this morning, but she's able to recreate meals and recipes and events from decades ago with kind of heartbreaking clarity. So there's a lot of periods of her life that are really rich and fascinating. She's a really important cookbook author. This cookbook / biography, it has sort of recipes and stories behind them, looks really interesting. And I think her life has got some great elements that could be turned into a really good movie.
You know, years ago, I read a biography of Julia Child, and it was really about her wooing her husband, Paul Child, and the way she did it. She had to like learn how to cook to do it. And I thought, wow, that would be a great movie. And of course, then it did become a movie with Meryl Streep and what's her name? Amy Adams. This is similar in a way because you could definitely see I don't know. I find it very interesting that she can, you know, Paula Wolfert can actually cook recipes and meals, even though she has Alzheimer's.
Are you talking about her book, My Life in France, her autobiography?
Oh, maybe. Was it an autobiography?
Yes.
Yeah, maybe it was an autobiography.
Yeah, it was written with her grandnephew, Alex Prudhomme. But it's a great book, My Life in France, and unfortunately became a half of a good movie. They should not have done the other half with the blogger, because the story with her and with Meryl Streep and Stanley Tucci was just charming. It would have been a lovely little movie all on its own.
Right, but and that really, to me, was the movie, was that, you know, she liked this guy, but, you know, his family was so, like, into cooking and into good food, and she knew nothing about it, so she had to learn how to cook to, like, woo him, and that's, like, how she became this chef, and I found that fascinating.
Mm-hmm. Well, that wraps up Book Filter, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. It moves us right along into Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines and entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, Dios mío, we get a chance to focus on the battle between Spanish language networks Telemundo and Univision, and we blow any goodwill by tossing in the only phrase in Spanish we can pronounce, which we just did. That's typical for the 56 million Americans who identify as Hispanic and Latino. They get a little attention come election time and sweeps week, or when someone points out how key a market they are for movies or TV shows is, or when they're trying to pronounce Puerto Rico, apparently. But it's usually done with a lack of nuance or understanding that the Spanish-speaking audience is just as diverse as the English-speaking one. Certainly the two biggest networks targeting this audience know it, and they are in a death match for that growing viewership. Univision has been in the post position for many years, but thanks to some key hit shows like Señora Acero and El Chemo.
You know, chemistry, chemo.
Ah, El Chemo.
He's like the cooker in drugs.
Ah, okay. Well, Telemundo is definitely closing the gap with those two shows. They are winning in some key demos and expect to end the year at number one in total viewers. That's kind of big. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. Like morning television, which usually moves at a glacial pace, the battle between these two channels has been a long time coming. And switching places is a really big deal, and could, and despite the fact being built on three particular series, which don't run forever, it feels like a real, a landmark moment in their battle.
And
it doesn't happen very often.
And it's El Quema, but I wonder, what about El Señor de los Cielos? Is that in there at all? Because that's their third hit show.
That's one of the, well, they have more than three, but yes, those are the biggest three hits that they have right now. Absolutely.
Yeah. Now speaking of, we kind of alluded to it in this last, that last story, but Donald Trump threatened NBC over its news coverage, showing ignorance of how broadcast licensing works and indifference to his oath to uphold the Constitution, including the First Amendment. Trump was unhappy with NBC and tweeted out that he might just decide to revoke their broadcast license. Unfortunately for him, NBC doesn't get or need a broadcast license from the FCC. However, individual stations owned by NBC do need a broadcast license. While the White House can't throw a spanner in the works, his complaint will surely push partisans to question the license for each station, adding expense and uncertainty to what should be a routine process. The Trump-installed head of the FCC refused to uphold the First Amendment and condemned Trump for threatening a network over its news coverage. So is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a very big deal. You can say, oh, it's just a tweet, it doesn't matter. But it actually can threaten their business, and it is important, and people should pay attention and not treat it lightly. And the FCC should not be politicized in this way, and the process should not be politicized. Nixon did it back in the 70s. He got businessmen, you know, wink, wink, nudge, nudge. He didn't order them to, but businessmen took up his cues and started to question licenses and made it really hard for individual stations that by any objective standard deserve to have their license renewed, get in trouble and have their business threatened. And it's NBC, and it's their NBC owned stations, but it affects everybody. You know, remember what they said in Germany, they came for the food channel and I did nothing.
Right.
You can't just say, well, it's not me. You have to speak out and up if something's systemically wrong. And this is that, and this really threatens all the networks and all the broadcasters of abusing the FCC and the licensing in this way. Everybody needs to be a lot more vocal to make sure this doesn't continue and happen.
Well, and you know, one of my beefs here among many, is that, you know, in speaking to the press last week, he kind of faulted NBC that the press just gets to write whatever they want, whether it's true or not.
It's called the First Amendment.
And then what I wanted to say is kind of like you get to go to Puerto Rico, stand in the midst of a human crisis. It's just a disaster zone down there. An entire island is just completely obliterated, and get to say, things are rosy, we're doing a great job, everything's fine here. Well, yeah, you got to say that because of the First Amendment. Well, guess what? The press gets to say what they say because of the First Amendment. It works both ways.
Yeah, what did you think of ESPN suspending Jemele Hill? People were angry and upset. She had another tweet. She didn't call for a boycott of the NFL, but she did imply and suggest that people might want to boycott the advertisers who are supporting particular teams or the NFL if they're not happy with something like the Dallas Cowboys owner did. My feeling was, you know, I waited to see what the deal was, what she'd actually tweeted, et cetera. And I feel like, you know, when you're telling people to boycott the advertisers of your network, essentially, I'm not quite that surprised that it would come with a suspension. You know, that's going to the heart of your business, you know. So I'm not really that up in arms over it.
Yeah, neither am I. And I think it's interesting that it should come on the same week as the New York Times actually laid out how they want their own journalists to behave on social media, what the guidelines are for what their presence should be and what they are and are not allowed to say.
What they want to tell them they're allowed and not allowed to say. Right. And I think Jemele Hill's on the side of the angels in terms of what she said politically. And I think she's right. And a lot of ESPN people speak up about controversial issues involving sports, which is what we're talking about here. It's just a different line when you say maybe you should boycott the advertisers. That's quite separate from just commenting on a controversy, which I think she has every right to do. And of course, I don't even agree with what the Times necessarily released. I read part of it and thought, it's tricky. It's difficult. And the rules change all the time.
Yes. Yes, indeed. Well, one of Stephen Sondheim's greatest musicals begins with the words, "Attend the tale of Sweeney Todd."
I thought you would sing it.
Oh, no.
Attend the tale of Sweeney Todd.
Oh, well. No, it's not. But you did, so now I don't have to. Well, guess what? That's exactly what theatergoers are doing for the Off-Broadway revival. I did want to see this because then you get to eat pies. I'm sure you'll explain after I'm done with this story. So these audiences are attending in record numbers, allowing the show to recruit and recover its $1.2 million budget in just 24 weeks. And it's playing at the Barrow Street Theater in Greenwich Village. For comparison, that venue's most recent smash hits included Tribes and a revival of Our Town. The latter show recouped its $400,000 budget, but it took 72 weeks, literally three times as long, to make back a third of Sweeney Todd's budget. The difference? Higher ticket prices. Off-Broadway is becoming a source of serious money, but it's doing it with higher prices and name brand fare like Broadway shows repurposed with a smaller cast and crew for smaller spaces. Think Avenue Q, Jersey Boys, and the like. I guess innovative fare and dramas will have to go to off-Broadway or Queens or, I don't know, even New Jersey? Go figure. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal. Yeah, Off-Broadway is, you know, Broadway is so insanely pricey. It's becoming opera. I mean, the average ticket price for Bruce Springsteen's show that people are paying on face value, not in the resale market, is $500. That's crazy. And now Off-Broadway is becoming what Broadway was just a couple years ago, you know, $150 to see a show. It's $80, $90, $100 for a lot of shows Off-Broadway. So I'm glad they're making money. The show, you know, built out a space and turned it into a pie shop. And if you pay extra, a premium price, yes, you get to have a pie before the show. And they're supposed to be really good.
Yeah.
But I haven't seen the show. I haven't eaten the pie. Everyone I know who's seen it has liked it. They're on their third cast already, but the reviews are still good from friends who've attended it. But yes, it's a bummer to see higher and higher ticket prices. That's just going to make it harder and harder for people to catch up, you know, for anything different and innovative to get a foothold. And, you know, the high ticket prices are spreading to London. Yeah. They're catching up with Broadway. An analysis of West End shows find that more than half of them have a ticket price £100 or more. And 5 years ago, no West End show had a ticket price of £100 or more. So, you know, it's getting to be a problem.
I love what the producer of Avenue Q said. He said, it's easy to have a shot at a commercial hit off Broadway. First, you have to win a Tony Award for Best Musical on Broadway.
Exactly, yeah. Avenue Q is doing great off Broadway.
Exactly.
So is Jersey Boys. Good Lord.
Now, who says the U.S. and Russia can't cooperate? In a deal that had to be approved by Vladimir Putin, of all people, opera star Anna Netrebko will star in three upcoming productions that will appear at the Bolshoi in Moscow and the Met in New York. They include Verdi's Aida, Strauss's Salome, and Wagner's Lohengrin.
Not taking any chances with those, are they?
No.
It's not like there's a new opera thrown in or something unusual.
If it's not 100 years old, you can't do it. They'll take place in 2019 through 2022, which amounts to a last-minute coup for opera standards when stars are locked up years in advance. Another diva will step out of the spotlight for a while. Patti LuPone is on Broadway opposite Christine Ebersole in the Tony-nominated show War Paint. Sadly, the trooper is in too much pain to reach the show's closing date. They're ending the run seven weeks early, so LuPone can get hip replacement surgery. Big deal or big whoop?
It's sad news for Patti LuPone and the show. You know that she must really be in pain to shut it down to 7 or 8 weeks before it ends, because that's just not her gig as a performer, and the show's not going to make money on Broadway. I know she wanted to continue out that run, so she must really be in pain.
Well, it was only filling 50% of the house, so...
No, but they were doing enough to make it. And of course, as that run came to an end, they were going to have an uptick in sales.
Okay.
Yeah, no, the show has not caught on fire, but they were still making money week to week. Though this is not a question of, you know, cutting out early. She's not pretending to need hip replacement surgery so they can shut the show down. That would be fine if they weren't making money, but they were eking out a profit many weeks, and they probably were doing some givebacks and things to try and help the show along. As far as Anna Netrebko, I just thank God the Met doesn't have to get approval from Trump in order to put on an opera.
Unbelievable. The Archie reboot Riverdale was pretty shaky creatively in season one. But fans insisted it got better, and the show had a decent audience by the standards of the CW, not to mention the usual outsized social media footprint given its teen audience. But the news gets better. The CW also saw a lot of sampling of the show once the season ended. People binge-watched all 13 episodes of the would-be noirish soap opera and spread the word. That meant season 2 opener was up, get this, Michael, 60% in the CW's key demo and up 50% in total viewers compared to season 1. In short, some 2.3 million people watched the season 2 opener, and those numbers should get bigger in the weeks to come. That's the biggest audience of teenagers since The Vampire Diaries at its peak in 2012. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. They may have a CW-sized hit on their hands. It's what we've seen for years, of course, whether it was syndicated reruns for Law & Order, now streaming, or for then DVD and Blu-ray, and now streaming. When you make prior seasons available, especially for a serialized show, it can really give people a chance to catch up. So there's always a chance of adding more viewers. You know, you're not going to start at one level and then just get smaller and smaller. So it's a really good success story for them.
Billboard is always juggling how to measure popularity of songs. They've long included both radio play and sales of 45s. But how much weight do they give to radio play versus the sale of singles? And what about the sale of albums with the single on it? Does that indicate popularity for a song as well? And should play and sales be 50-50? 60-40? Believe me, that formula has changed in many ways over the years, and streaming means it had to change again. Now Billboard is thinking of adding another stat into the mix. Get this, YouTube plays. They're consulting with labels and artists since the formula they use has a massive impact. No decision has been made yet, but with YouTube play revealing so much about hot songs, it seems inevitable. This might even include fan-generated videos that include an artist's music, not just official ones. That would be interesting. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. Every time they mess with the formula, it is. Frankly, I assumed the YouTube plays were already included in the mix. I can't believe they're not.
As did I. I thought for sure that, you know, since they're so available, that you may as well just lump them in there. But I was pretty shocked to find out that they weren't included.
And of course, we had a story a few weeks ago where a new music exec who joined YouTube said, oh my gosh, I was crazy. I thought YouTube was shorting us, but in fact, we're putting out lots of money. We're spending money to everyone. And they got some pushback saying, actually, no, you're not paying anywhere near what Spotify and Apple and others are paying. And we have some new stats about that. Basically, YouTube is playing a little bit of a game where they only included the videos with ads on them. So there are artist videos that don't have ads attached to them. And they weren't including that when they figured out how much money they're paying out to artists. So if you include all the artist plays on YouTube, in fact, what they're paying out to record labels and authors and everybody who gets pennies from this, you know, the video views amounts to, where is it?
$1.20 per thousand, per thousand plays. So if, I don't know, Despacito was played 1,000 times, the, you know, publisher gets paid $1.20.
Right. That's the cost per thousand, the CPM, sort of like the to reach 1,000 eyeballs. It's what it costs or what money is generated. So it is $1.20. If you include just the ones where they tap ads onto it, they're still at about $3.
Correct.
And that's about equivalent to what Spotify has for their free service. Spotify's free service level does have ads and they generate $2.11. But the real money is under paid subscriptions. Spotify, Apple, and others, when you're at a paid subscription level, they're generating about $6 per CPM. So for every 1,000 people viewing something, $6 is going back out there. So that's double or almost five times what YouTube is generating, depending on which stat you want to use. So they're significantly lower than the paid level. That's where the money is. That's where Spotify and Apple are at. And that's where labels and artists are pointing to YouTube and saying, you're not paying your fair share.
That's correct. And I can tell you from experience, my kids, my daughters, you know, I'll say, what are you watching on YouTube? And they're saying, oh, nothing. We're just listening to music.
Yeah, it happens all the time.
Well, that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week, Michael, and moves us right along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. Today, we're going to study the morning TV news race. Now, you might be asking why, and the reason why is because NBC apparently hasn't been. They forked over tens of millions of dollars to steal Megyn Kelly away from Fox News and then realized they had nowhere to put her. First, they gave Kelly a summer run in prime time with a news magazine show opposite the ratings legend 60 Minutes. That should have been her wheelhouse, but instead it was a ratings disaster and gave NBC bad press for her choice in stories. Then NBC turned to the Today Show, a four-hour ratings powerhouse that prints money for the network and has been firing on all cylinders. Today had lost the morning crown to ABC's Good Morning America, but in what amounts to lightning speed for that day part, they've been taking it back, actually, in the past year. Instead of leaving well enough alone, NBC shoehorned Kelly into the 9 a.m. hour, displacing weatherman Al Roker's time slot and making everyone unhappy behind the scenes. The result? Falling ratings, and more bad press. To analyze this mess, we're joined by our friend Mark Berman, the rating guru and editor-in-chief at Programming Insider, who has covered television and the ups and downs of Nielsen ratings for many years. Mark, thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So tell us, Mark, is there any good news to share about Megyn Kelly and her stint on the Today Show and in prime time for NBC? Are there some younger demos she's bringing to the network? Is she bringing in more men? What's happening?
There's no good news. This is a colossal failure. It reminds me of going back way back when they ousted Jane Pauley and they brought in Deborah Norville. Ugh. And viewers fled in droves. This is a huge mistake. They're going to need to fix this immediately.
Well, thanks for joining us, Mark. It's been a pleasure.
and it's not a surprise because we had our reservations from the get-go, and you certainly publicly talked about the fact that she's not a morning personality.
Here's
a shark, and that may work in prime time or on a 24-hour news channel, but morning television is like a teddy bear, you know? Even if you're dealing with world leaders and you're asking serious questions, it's just a different tempo and chemistry than you'll find on a 24-hour news channel in prime time. And she just never – it made no sense to anyone, really, including you, and you talked about it at the time, didn't you?
It made no sense. You know, you have to look at it this way. When you're looking at morning television, your target audience is older women. And the primary demographic is 25 to 54 women, but realistically, it's really women over 50 plus. Megyn Kelly does not have that, you know, gosh golly warm personality where she could bubble in the morning. That's not who she is. And she's trying to be something that she is not. And NBC, the red flag should have gone up. When she was still at Fox News, she did a special, a primetime special for Fox, where she sat with four guests, including Donald Trump, before he became president. And she suddenly was warmer and friendlier and sweeter. It didn't work. It was a huge failure. NBC should have realized that. Instead of thinking, what can we do with her? They just, they bid to get her. And then, as you said, they didn't know what to do with her. And to put her in the middle of the Today Show, which was doing fine at the time, is like taking it. It's basically taking a franchise and potentially causing permanent damage. So they better fix this really soon.
Well, let me ask you something, because certainly I think when Michael suggested, hey, let's cover Megyn Kelly, I thought, well, do our listeners who are all over the world, do they care? He reminded me that, hey, remember, this is a journalist and a news host who has kind of hosted and was the anchor for a presidential debate and became a part of the news story. And even that's not helping, is it?
No, you know, you have to remember, she came from Fox News, which is a whole different ballgame. It's a different mentality. Everything's different about it. She did very well on Fox News in primetime. She covered politics. She covered what was going on. That's what she did. She did it very well. And ultimately, logically, she didn't want to stay with Fox News. So you want to do something that you're comfortable in, and basically that's who you are. It's not to say that you can't try something else, but to go from primetime on Fox News into NBC in the morning, that makes absolutely no sense. And I've been watching it religiously. I've written about it. I've been watching it. And she's trying to be something that she just isn't. And you know, as an example, let's use Katie Couric as an example. Now, mm-hmm. Katie came in way back when, during that whole disaster, when Deborah Norville stepped in for Jane Pauley. Katie was already on the show and they upped her. And, you know, she had that warm, bubbly, sweet personality. She fit like a glove in the morning. Well, then Katie, 15 years later, or however many years it was, decides, I want to leave the Today Show. And she goes to CBS as the anchor of the CBS Evening News. She didn't fit in there because that's not who she was. So that didn't work out for her. So ultimately, the moral of the story is, when you're known for doing something, don't completely deviate from it and suddenly decide, gee, I should be on in the morning, you know, having cooking segments and talk. You know, it just doesn't work. And their ratings are plummeting. Their ratings are plummeting. This is a problem.
And it didn't work for Matt Lauer either. It's not just the women. He tried to do a primetime presidential debate where he hosted some Republican candidates. And that was a disaster for him in critically speaking. It didn't do great in the ratings either, I don't think. But
no,
he did not handle
no,
that well.
Disaster. But, you know, and the minute they announced we're bringing in Megyn Kelly, suddenly Tamron Hall is gone. She's immediately gone. Why did they didn't need to do it? Because 9 a.m. on the Today Show, Monday to Friday, was in good shape. There was no problem with it. Why do you need to fix something that isn't broken? So already, you know, they just didn't hit this whole thing. And they make it seem like we're this, you know, fun, friendly family. And it just doesn't work. It just does not work. So I don't think she's going to be sitting in 9 a.m. in the morning for very long.
Well, you're kind of saying that hosts, newscasters, anchors shouldn't necessarily try to be something that they're not or that they're not known for. And yet with actors, like let's say a Robin Williams or a Jim Carrey, they can go from playing comedy to maybe doing a serious role and even winning, you know, awards for kind of being serious all of a sudden instead of being a comedian. Is that because, hey, they're just playing a part and audiences expect them to be different, whereas with newscasters and anchors and journalists, we expect them to kind of maintain their role, maintain the way we know them?
Yes. But I'll give you an example of something. You know, this, you have to look at her show in the morning as a talk show. It's like a feel-good talk show. You know, we've had dozens and dozens of personalities come into daytime talk, whether it's the morning, the afternoon, and some have done very well. You know, Ellen DeGeneres, Oprah Winfrey, you have people that sit in those chairs for decades. And then you have people that come in that just do not belong there because they don't have that personality to do it. For example, I don't know if you remember this, but a number of years ago, Roseanne hosted a daytime talk show. And Roseanne wasn't known for that mentality of, you know, slapping people on the back and hugging them. That wasn't Roseanne. And suddenly she's sitting in a daytime talk show, you know, having light conversation. It didn't work. It was a huge failure. And there are so many examples of that. So when you're going to tackle a talk show format, particularly in daytime, you have to have a certain type of personality to do it. Now, Megyn Kelly, maybe this really is Megyn Kelly. Maybe she's funny and frolicky, and maybe that's who she is. But to come from Fox News, where you're a serious political reporter, nailing stories, she was a tough, tough personality, and she did a very good job there.
Right. So now NBC has not talked about the ratings since she's jumped into the job, but Page Six had a story and they quoted an anonymous source. The ratings are down 30% from 1 year earlier, though it's unclear to me whether they mean overnights or demos or total viewers. And is it live plus three or whatever? And it also says that the ratings for the hour following her, this is the real problem for NBC, Kathleen and Hoda have the hour at the 10 a.m. slot. That's down 26% from 1 year earlier because they have a much weaker lead-in. So that story got picked up. Everybody reported on it. But the only source is an anonymous figure that released this information. My question is, I thought Nielsen ratings were kind of like movie box office grosses. I thought once they were out, that everybody had access to them. Everybody in advertising, everyone in Hollywood, everyone at the networks, every 500 cable channels, they all must have access to this information. And I'm wondering why it has to be an anonymous source talking to Page Six to get the facts out about what her ratings are.
That's a little tricky with the ratings. Everybody does not have access to it. The way it works is, particularly if you're doing something like I do, you get ratings from various sources about various shows. Now, logically, you're going to get ratings from a certain network or a certain distributor when the ratings are positive. When the ratings are not good, they're not going to send you anything. So in other words, you're not going to get a press release of Megyn Kelly today down 32%. They're not going to send that. Just not going to happen. However, if it was just the opposite, Megyn Kelly today up 32%, they'd be screaming off the rooftop. So in my job where I sit, I have to decipher everything that's coming in and I have to decide if this is real or not. So any data out there, it's not readily available to the public. And it's kind of like, you know, for me, I would have to go to somebody to get it. They're not going to give it to me unless the ratings are really positive. And I'll tell you what the main, I want to tell you, it's very interesting. Now, she's only 1 hour, but as you said, she leads into Kathy Lee and Hoda. And when you have a small lead and when you're dropping by like 30% or whatever it is, that's going to negatively impact the next hour. And that show is a case point why somebody like Kathy Lee belongs in that role. That's what she does, and she does it well. You know, so I think NBC is going to have to fix this. What could happen? This has never happened before. You know, I took a look at the ratings for the week of October 8th. Now, this is, the week of October 2nd. And ABC, Good Morning America, was the most watched of the three shows, 4.4 million. The Today Show had 4.1 million. But this is very interesting. On CBS, their show had 3.7 million. So wow. if this continues, CBS could ultimately inch into number two. That's never happened.
Well, I mean, so wow. What do they do with Megyn Kelly? And I mean, NBC, can they, I mean, as you mentioned, she is kind of more of a hardcore journalist, as was seen during that presidential debate where Donald Trump went after her afterwards. Thus, she became part of the story. Do they then shift her away from morning television and then maybe make her a part of, you know, have her join Brian Williams on MSNBC or move over to the business channel CNBC?
Well, I think there's a couple of things they could do with her. First of all, I mean, I don't know exactly what they paid. I mean, there's rumors, there's various figures out there, but according to the most common figure, they paid her $25 million a year or something like that, which is a lot of money.
$17 million a year.
I, They must remove her from daytime because it's really going to hurt them. The longer she's sitting there, the more damage is going to be. They could easily put her onto Dateline. She could work on Dateline. But I think the logical answer is move her over to cable, move her over to MSNBC, move her over to CNBC. You know, those networks could certainly need a push. And that's what she's known for doing. And she's very good at that. So why not do that? And, you know, utilize her to kind of, you know, and to kind of tweet, you know, get more people to watch those networks on cable. And then ultimately they need to decide, is this really going to be a 3-year deal with her? I mean, what do we do? Do we settle now? I mean, what exactly do we do? And the thing to keep in mind, there really are, there's another big colossal mistake NBC made a number of years ago in late night. They took Jay Leno off the Tonight Show. They put him in primetime. They brought in Conan O'Brien. Viewers flocked. They fled in droves. The show was damaged. And they immediately put Leno back. And within a little bit of time, everything went back to normal. So I think at this point, you know, it's not working. I don't think that the pendulum is going to shift in the upward direction. And I think they really need to figure this out now. Because you don't want to hurt the Today Show. This is a cash cow. You don't want to hurt this show.
Well, now I would a couple of things I would say. One is that to point out the problems she's having, people don't want to be booked on her hour. Celeb bookers are keeping their clients away because she's had problems with Will and Grace cast, with Jane Fonda. So it's not just the ratings are down. They're going to have a lot of trouble booking guests because people don't want to be anywhere near her. That's not a good positive experience for what they're trying to promote. But I don't think they should move her to MSNBC. They're at record ratings. And Megyn Kelly is poison to the audience that MSNBC has been cultivating for years. So, you know, she's not going to fit in on MSNBC. You know, that's not going to work for them. That will damage a brand that is also growing. Just like Today Show was printing money, MSNBC is doing better than it ever has before. So throwing Megyn Kelly in the mix there, that could damage that world and not help them at all. So I don't know what they do with her, but I don't see an easy fit. And she's not really a journalist. She's a head of a talk show. Like Bill O'Reilly and Sean Hannity and Rachel Maddow. You know, she's not a journalist breaking stories. She's a personality, and her personality is primetime news coverage. Fox News should grab her back if they could, but I don't know if they even need her. I don't know how Tucker Carlson and Sean Hannity seem to be doing okay there.
Well, you know, what's interesting about Fox News, you know, she was their second most watched show behind Bill O'Reilly. And to me, at least, you know, from my personal observation, I think she left there on a sour note. She left there, you know, she didn't leave there on pot. Look, things were going on there. I'm not going to get into that, you know, but I don't think she left there really. I don't think anybody looked at her and said, wow, she's, you know, this wonderful person and she's got this great opportunity to go to NBC. I think everybody out there was like, what the heck is NBC thinking bringing her in? So she's not the warmest and fuzziest person. And as you said, she got off to a very iffy start, you know, with the whole Will and Grace thing and Jane Fonda. So they could ultimately, listen, contracts are made to be broken. It's going to cost NBC a lot of money. They invested a lot of money in her, but then I think you have to also think of what's the long-term solution. As you said, if they ship her to MSNBC and suddenly the ratings drop there, you don't want that either. So I think, you know, I always say you have to give a show time. You have to, you know, people need time to kind of find their niche. But we live in a different world now. And I think, you know, it's been perceived as so negative and the ratings are so down. I don't see this turning around.
Well, couldn't she go up against Rachel Maddow and like a Hannity and Combs? It could be Maddow and Kelly.
If they were in idiots, yes.
Well, you know, again, I've been watching the show every morning. And I just think it's such a clunky fit. You know, she's trying to make herself like this average person, you know, like she's like everybody else. She's not like everybody else. You know, she's not. Oprah Winfrey had the it factor. Oprah had that. You know, you have other people, you know, your Kathy Lee has it. Ellen DeGeneres has it. Wendy Williams has it. You know, a lot of these personalities have it. Megyn Kelly doesn't have that. That's not who she is. So I think, you know, for herself and NBC, I think the sooner they fix this or try to repair it, the better they'll be. You shouldn't put it off.
Now you have a, people should go to programminginsider.com. We'll have links in our show notes. And you also have a great daily newsletter, which deals with overnight ratings. And that brings up a question of ratings. A lot of networks can't wean themselves off the fact that they want you to talk about the overnight ratings. You also link to the Live Plus 3 ratings. You constantly update them. But do you feel like there's too much emphasis on overnight ratings? Do you feel like the networks aren't telling their best story by waiting for the Live Plus 3 and Live Plus 7? You know, it's the world we live in. Of course, everybody wants information right away. But a lot of ratings don't come out until they release them. Like USA Today has a weekly chart, and that's just overnight ratings. And we've got you. But when it comes to morning and late night and cable and syndicated, it's kind of catch as catch can until someone like you is able to get information and report on it. I'm just in a, I don't even know what's going on. I mean, Jimmy Fallon has fallen to third place, perhaps, in late night behind Jimmy Kimmel and Stephen Colbert, and I didn't even realize that. So do you feel like ratings is in such huge flux? Do you feel like there's a need for some new way to talk about how much people are watching TV shows? Because something like This Is Us, it's got 25 million people watching each episode. That's amazing.
Well, I'll tell you what's very tricky about the ratings now. And before I do that, let me address the overnights. You know, I've been criticized for years that you shouldn't be looking at the overnights. Don't look at the overnights. I don't agree with that, and I'll tell you why. When you look at the overnight ratings, now remember, these are based on 56 metered markets across the country. So it's not a full sample, but it'll give you an initial look as to what to expect. You know, you look at a certain show like last night, you know, you knew that football on the night on NBC, you know, 60 Minutes had an audience. It gives you an initial look in terms of what the other ratings are going to look like, because then you get the fast affiliate numbers, which are time period based. Then you get the Live Plus same day data. Then you get the data with the DVR usage. And then, of course, you get the Live Plus 7 day. But nobody can wait a week. Nobody can wait that long. This is a business where everybody wants the information yesterday. So when I put out the overnights, it's just a first look to see, you know, what these numbers look like. So I think that's how you have to look at the overnights. But here's where it gets tricky. With so much data out there, it's very easy for somebody, any outlet, to spin something, to make a show look like, you know, it's a big hit when it really isn't. And I'll give you an example of a network, the CW. Traditionally, they don't get high ratings. They get very small ratings. But their success is really based on social media. You have a show like The Flash, which maybe will get 4 million viewers, which is not a lot. But in social media, you know, you go to Comic-Con, it's all over the place. So there's a lot of different ways to look at various things, but you have to be very careful because it's very easy for somebody to spin, you know, something that isn't working and make it sound like it's a big hit. You have to be careful.
Well, that's why we need your analysis every day of the overnight ratings to keep that long-term perspective going. So I appreciate you taking the time to talk with us about Megyn Kelly and the TV ratings. And we'll send people to programminginsider.com and your newsletter. Is there a Twitter feed that you'd like people to follow or anything else that we should tell them about?
Oh, I appreciate that. You could. I have a few Twitter feeds, but probably the easiest one is just at my name, Mark Berman. Mark with a C, Berman.
Great. Well, thanks very much for joining us here today on Showbiz Sandbox, and we look forward to hearing from you again soon.
Thank you for having me. Have a great day.
Well, that was very nice of Mark Berman to join us. I always love talking to him. He definitely knows what he's talking about when it comes to television.
That's right. He's a big fan of television. He loves classic TV, and he's a geek like me when it comes to the ratings.
You're pretty bad. Okay, so that, you know,
I wish I could get full. Believe me, what drives me nuts is that I don't have access. He says people won't wait for the Live Plus 7. I'll wait. I'd love to wait. I would love to get the Live Plus 7 for prime time for all of 24 hours. I'd love to get regular updates on the morning shows and the late night shows and syndicated. It drives me crazy. I really want a chart of the top shows of every day. I don't care whether you're on Today's Show or Jimmy Fallon or in prime time or on the Food Channel. I would love a list of every show over like a million viewers.
Well, one of the top shows back in the day, one of those classic TV shows that Mark Berman likes, was I Love Lucy.
That's right. I Love Lucy is one of the all-time greats. You think about big hits today, they pale in comparison to I Love Lucy. But that does bring us to the obituary section, because Bob Shiller was a writer on I Love Lucy and All in the Family and lots of other shows. And he just died at 98. He was a legend in writing. He partnered throughout most of his career with Bob Weisskopf. And I imagine people are saying, get me the Bobs, you know, Bob Schiller and Bob Weiss, get me the Bobs. We need Bobs to give us an episode. And they had a long-term professional partnership. They wrote the I Love Lucy episode about grape stomping in Italy. They wrote the one where John Wayne showed up. They wrote the two-part episode for All in the Family where Edith is attacked and almost raped. That storyline was actually originally created for One Day at a Time and the Bonnie Franklin character, but Norman Lear said, you know what? I want to show this could happen to anyone. Bonnie Franklin was sort of the sexy young star of One Day at a Time, a hot-to-trot divorcee. That's a stereotype. I shouldn't have said that. And instead, he said, let's do Edith. Nobody would picture Edith being attacked and raped, but it can happen because it's not about your physical appearance. It's about power and terror. And so they flipped it and put it for All in the Family. And that's a little factoid that I learned from Mark Berman's Programming Insider. He just mentioned that yesterday in the trivia that he includes in his daily newsletter. So check it out. So Bob Schiller won Emmys for All in the Family and The Flip Wilson Show. They wrote for a lot of stuff. Make Room for Daddy, My Favorite Husband, The Lucy Desi Comedy Hour. They're just all over the place. They wrote for the 60s, the 70s, and 80s. They did an entire run practically of The Lucy Show. So they really had a great relationship with her. He's just a great guy. And I love this quote. When he was asked once the reason for the success of their partnership, he said, that's easy. We never agreed on anything. To which the other Bob said, yes, we have.
That is very funny. And we never agree on anything.
Absolutely. Of course we do. What?
Well, the one thing we can agree on is that you said
people should rate and review the show.
That is correct. That is absolutely correct. We do agree on that.
You didn't do it. You've been listening to us for over an hour. God bless you.
That's true.
You haven't rated and reviewed the show. It'll take you 30 seconds, 10 seconds, 15 seconds. Do it for the children.
And you can do it in iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher. That information, as well as links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode, can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find those ways to contact us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can follow us on Twitter, where our handle is @showbizsandbox, or you can like us on Facebook. If you search for Showbiz Sandbox, our page should come up. It's facebook.com/showbizsandbox. Again, all of this information is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Gilt has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's rateandreviewtheshow.com. Or, if you prefer, go to brokenrecord.com.
Well, if you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry there, why not head on over to the Huffington Post or michaelgiltz.com, where all of his work is aggregated. Of course, don't forget to check out bookfilter.com. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. And until next week, play nice.